Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. About 4 million miles of roads crisscross the United States, and odds are you've driven probably quite a few of them, and you've probably seen some roadkill laying on the shoulder. Our next guest says roads cause lots of problems for wildlife, and roadkill is only the start. We're talking about the book Crossings, fascinating book. The subtitle is How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. And author Ben Goldfarb is with us. He's an independent conservation journalist. He also wrote the book Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. It was a great book, and we had a great conversation about it. The book is the winner of the 2019 Penn E.O. Wilson Literary Science Writing Award, and I think we interviewed him back in 2019 about it. And while we talk with Ben about road ecology, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us maybe the effects of your local roads and what they're having on the land. How often do you see roadkill? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Ben Goldfarb, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Larry, thank you so much. It's great to be back.
So let's start with road ecology. How do you define road ecology?
It's a great question. So road ecology is basically it's the field of science that looks at all of the different ways that roads shape nature and what we do about that, right? And obviously the most conspicuous manifestation of how roads and nature interact is roadkill. You know, we've all seen the dead deer or turkey or raccoon or opossum, but that's really, you know, as you said, kind of the tip of the iceberg, right? We're applying 20 million tons of road salt to our highways that run off into our rivers and lakes and, you know, make them brackish. Road noise pollution is a huge problem that's driving wild animals away from large swaths of habitat. You've got tire particles bleeding into streams and causing fish kills in some parts of the country. So road ecology is, again, it's kind of the discipline that looks at all of those different connections and how we manage and mitigate all of those ecological harms that roads cause.
You know, someone might say, well, animals are pretty good at adapting to challenges and changes in their environment. Why can't they just get used to roads and avoid them? That's what some people might say to you, Ben.
Yeah, you know, and look, some animals do that to some extent. You know, the coyotes in Chicago very famously look both ways before crossing the street, and they'll use the crosswalks at red lights, you know, and there are amazing stories of evolution happening on roads. You know, cliff swallows, those birds that nest under highway overpasses and bridges, you know, they're evolving to get shorter wings, which makes them more maneuverable, and they're better able to avoid 18-wheelers as a result. So animals are evolving and adapting in interesting ways. But, you know, I think the challenge is that, look, they've got millions of years of evolutionary history without cars, and all of a sudden, you know, cars show up a century ago, and that's just, a big, fast predator that they're not accustomed to.
And they're just a sort of a fact of life for us, for humans at least. And I was intrigued. I found it really interesting. You did a little history cars and car and road history. What did the public think about cars and roads when they were being invented?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We think about America as being such a car-loving country, but when cars, you know, first start proliferating in the early 1900s, most Americans hated the car. You know, here was this terrifying, dangerous new machine that's taking over city streets and, you know, killing lots of children. And there were these big sort of safety parades. You know, cities including Milwaukee had these huge demonstrations against cars. And, you know, and that's really where this science of road ecology comes from. You know, in the 1920s, biologists say, hey, this new technology, the car, it's damaging cities, it's killing lots of humans. What's it doing to our wildlife? So, you know, starting in the 20s, you get all of these wildlife biologists driving around Iowa and Illinois and other states, counting up, dead woodpeckers and brown squirrels and garter snakes and saying, holy cow, this is, you know, really an immense impact on our wildlife. This new machine, the automobile, is really a huge problem. So this idea of road ecology goes back a century.
Well, it is interesting. You know, you can drive your car along the roads and you're zipping along and you might... Well, I drove to Milwaukee, which is about 70 miles here recently, and I counted 8 dead deer along the road. But,
wow.
Which was amazing. And it was like 1 every 10 miles or so, or 9 miles or so. But when you're on a bicycle, I did a 300-mile bike ride, and then you really get to see not only, you know, deer, but small animals, insects, birds. It is an enormous amount that you see.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm always amazed whenever I walk or bike along a highway, just how many birds you see. You know, there are something like 300 million birds killed by cars every year. And, you know, the vast majority of them we don't notice. But it's certainly a huge issue. I mean, I think about reptiles and amphibians too. You know, the frogs, the salamanders, the turtles, the snakes. You know, these are animals that we don't think much about, I think, from a roadkill perspective, because look, you know, when you hit a white-tailed deer, you know, that's a dangerous, expensive event, right? That messes up your car, and you know, there are actually several hundred drivers killed every year in deer collisions. So we think a lot about deer collisions, but we don't think much about salamander squishings and toad crushings, you know, because those aren't threats to us as drivers. But you're right, Larry, that when you walk or bike along a roadway, it's just it's astonishing how many small critters you see, and you know, most of those little deaths aren't being counted in any way.
Yeah, so maybe it'd be good to give our listeners a sort of a thumbnail about your book Crossings and how it's laid out. It's really fascinating.
Well, thanks, Larry. Yeah, so let's see. So you know, as we've been discussing, the book is really about sort of the history of this scientific field, road ecology, which really begins with roadkill, right? All of these biologists counting up dead animals along America's roadsides in the early 1900s. But, you know, over time, you know, wildlife biologists and road ecologists start to look at these other issues that roads create as well. You know, one of the big problems is this barrier effect that roads impose on animals, right? There's this steady stream of traffic that's, you know, racing along so many of our major highways, and a lot of animals don't even attempt to cross the roads. They don't get hit by cars because they're not even trying to cross, but that barrier has its own problems. You know, animals they lose immense areas of habitat. You know, there have been big starvation events in mule deer in states like Wyoming and Idaho because, you know, these deer don't try to cross the road at all, and as a result they get caught in these big snowfalls and they can't find their way down to their winter range, and they'll die off, you know, not because they've been hit by cars, but because roads have, you know, cost them all of this habitat that they'd like to be able to access. You know, there are amazing examples of genetic fragmentation, you know, populations of mountain lions that have become incredibly inbred because, you know, no new mountain lions can cross the freeway to mate with, you know, these little trapped populations. So that's really what you know, the history of road ecology is. It's just figuring out all of these different issues that roads create and figuring out how to deal with them. And a lot of the book is about wildlife crossing structures, you know, overpasses, underpasses, tunnels, you know, typically flanked by fences that guide the animals to the crossings. And, you know, how do we know where to build those? How do we know that they work? You know, what types of animals use what types of structures? So, you know, I think the book ultimately tries to be somewhat hopeful. You know, yes, yeah, roads create all of these problems, but, you know, we're also increasingly figuring out how to deal with those problems and the, you know, the kinds of infrastructural changes we can make to make our roads less disastrous for nature.
Yeah. Bill in Barneveld has something for us. Bill, hi.
Yeah, you had Joe a few years ago talking about wildlife conservation in Laos and Vietnam, and I just want to add a perspective from that, where I work on wildlife conservation. A lot of studies have shown that the main impact on wildlife and biodiversity from commercial logging in Asia isn't from the removal of trees or the cutting of the forest. It comes from the logging roads that open up access to the area for poachers and hunters and small-scale agriculture. The logging is fairly selective. It's not generally clear cut, but once those roads are in, it's almost impossible to roll those impacts back of the access provided by the roads.
Yeah, Bill, thanks a lot. And you deal with that. One chapter I'm thinking about is your chapter on the Amazon forest in Brazil.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, that Bill's comment gets at a really important point, which is that, look, the roads themselves are problems, but you know, really one of the most dramatic problems is the land use change that they facilitate, right? Before you can illegally log the Amazon or any other rainforest, you know, you need roads to get the machinery in and get the product out, right? And as soon as a road enters an area, you know, you see, you know, slash and burn, clear cutting and you know, huge amounts of new cattle grazing on what used to be rainforest. And, you know, so it's true that roads, you know, are sort of at the root of all of these different ecological problems and industrial impacts on nature.
And we're going to talk some more about that with Ben Goldfarb. His book is titled Crossings, the subtitle, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. Ben will be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Ben, and you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the book titled Crossings, How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. And our guest is the author, Ben Goldfarb. Lucky to have him back with us. He's an independent conservation journalist. He authored the book Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter. And we talked with Ben about that. And now we're talking with him about his latest book, Crossings. So, questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Steve in St. Germain will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, just two comments to make, or two points to make. One is that there's a professor, a high school teacher out in the East Coast somewhere, I think in either Vermont or New Hampshire. He actually teaches his students about animals and their habitat based on where they find them dead along the road. He's actually, I think his name is Dr. Splat, he goes by. And so the kids go out and they log down what they find along the road, and then they talk about the habitat adjacent to that, and it's kind of a fun way to get them to learn, or unusual, about habitat and then seasonal movements of the animals. And then the second thing is that I actually have a roadkill contest that I've run for various conferences that I've done over the years. I'm a retired fisheries biologist for the state. And Midwest Fish and Wildlife Conference, and that's always been great fun, where it's basically the concept is I have pictures of roadkill, and you're basically out down the highway, and it's as you're traveling along, say, 55, 65 miles an hour, you always see that thing along the road and go, what was that? And so I give people 3 seconds to say what it is, and there's a single elimination, there's prizes, it's quite fun. But really, it's not all animals. It's other odds and ends along that road that I've collected over the years of taking pictures of.
Steve, thanks for a comment, man, on either of Steve's points.
Well, yeah, Splat. I want to be the guest photo judge for Steve's next roadkill contest. No, but I think the doctor, I'm not familiar with Dr. Splat, the high school teacher, although I wish I'd taken that class growing up. But, you know, I think that, you know, to Steve's point, I mean, there's a lot we can learn from roadkill, right? And there's, you know, roadkill is sort of the basis for, you know, many scientific studies. You know, it's sort of this inadvertent sampling method. You know, cars are telling us, you know, where populations are moving. There are studies showing changing animal distributions due to climate change that use roadkill samples as, you know, sort of their evidence that, you know, that populations are shifting. You know, there are examples of invasive species being discovered thanks to roadkill, even species that, you know, that scientists thought were extinct and get rediscovered as a roadkill specimen that happened with a lizard in Australia. So you know, roadkill, even though it's certainly a tragedy in this enormous form of biodiversity loss, also tells us a lot about biodiversity in its own right.
I think there's an organization with the acronym SPLAT in your book, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe yes. I am.
No, you're right. There's a group called Project Splatter in the UK, based in Wales, that it was essentially this big citizen science project that relied on people driving around, logging the roadkill they saw, just like Dr. Splat students, submitting those observations to a database, and then those observations got used in many scientific studies. Unfortunately, Project Splatter had to change its name to the much more boring Road Lab, because all of these cat lovers thought that splatter was kind of insensitive to the cats. I don't know. I was disappointed about that. I like Project Splatter.
Oh man, Sally in Lanesboro, Minnesota. Well, go to you now. Hi, Sally.
Hey, Larry. So when I'm driving down the road, I drive a lot. When I'm driving down the road, I can't not look. I have to look. I kind of consider roadkill my hobby. I don't remember where I was. I should have written it down, but it's like Nevada or New Mexico or Texas or Arizona. I saw a dead armadillo. That was really interesting. I almost stopped and went back to look at it closer, but I was on a big interstate. So I'm really looking forward to reading this guy's book about roadkill, and I'm loving that it may help to save some of the little creatures' lives. I have a particular problem in my coulees of Fillmore County. There's a lot of raccoons that get killed, and the raccoons sit along the side of the road, and then the eagles come down and get them, and then the eagles get hit by cars, and it just breaks your heart when you see a dead eagle. So it's my hobby now to stop and pull the dead raccoons off the side of the road, and I'd like to challenge your listeners to also pull the raccoons off to save these eagles. I know it's dangerous. So try to be, careful, but that's my little challenge to the listeners to save an eagle.
All right. And eagles are slow to take off, and that's a problem here in Wisconsin. Sally's in Minnesota, but roadkill deer are another problem in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely. Out west where I live in Colorado, and other western states, we also have golden eagles as well. I don't know if you guys have those in Wisconsin, but certainly both both bald eagles and golden eagles get hit frequently by cars because they're scavenging along the roadsides, as that listener suggested. And there's actually there's a cool project. I tell this story in the book. There's basically this big research project. Based in Utah, Wyoming, and Oregon, that basically did a bunch of sort of road surveys and figured out that the optimal distance to drag a carcass off the road is 40 feet. And if you drag the carcass 40 feet away from the road, that's far enough that the eagles can feast on the carcass in peace without getting hit by cars and without getting flushed off the carcass by traffic. And now there's actually this big project that's starting this winter to do that, where basically road crews will be hired in several western states to drag all of those dead deer, elk, and antelope away from the side of the highway so that eagles can use that resource safely. So certainly, for those scavengers, roadkill is a resource, but it's potentially a dangerous one. And as Sally suggests, there are things we can do to make that resource a little bit safer for raptors especially.
Yeah. Allison and Racine will give you a chance. Hi, Allison.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a comment and a question. My comment is, in southeastern Wisconsin, anyone who lives near the Foxconn facility has seen terrible roads built and expanded for that facility, which didn't turn out to be what it was. And they took a 2-lane highway, which was sufficient, and turned it into a 6-lane road. So that was really awful to see that expansion. They removed a lot of homes and things, too, and I can't imagine what it did to the wildlife in the area. But a study that was recently done showed that there are fewer car accidents on narrow roads than on wide roads. And I'm just wondering if your book gives any sort of advice or ideas to people how to maybe reach out to local politicians, legislators, and talk about alternatives to these gigantic roads that are built in our country that really are not necessary in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm. Ben?
Yeah, it's a really good question and a really important one. And I think that, you know, the point that the listener is making, which is absolutely right, is that, you know, we generally, humans don't drive as fast as the posted speed limit says. We drive as fast as the road wants us to go, right? And really wide, straight roads are roads that we tend to just instinctively drive very fast on, which is dangerous for both, you know, humans and wildlife. So certainly narrowing road widths and creating roads that are designed to compel drivers to go more slowly is one really great solution, both to you know, pedestrian fatalities and to to wildlife mortality. One of the really cool roads I visited in working on this project was in Brazil, where there's a road through a park, through a state park, and there they had built the road to be intentionally very sinuous with lots of, you know, hairpin turns, just to force drivers to go more slowly for the sake of wildlife. So I think that listener is exactly right that, you know, we should be in sensitive areas, both for humans and wildlife. We should be designing roads that, you know, compel slower speeds, because that's, you know, those lower design speeds are much more effective than just changing the posted limit. You know, as for how to engage local politicians and officials, you know, I don't think it's any more complicated than any other issue. You know, it's something that you just have to show up for, write letters for, attend local planning meetings and hearings, and just put the work in. And there are some really wonderful examples of communities that have advocated for safer infrastructure. You know, Teton County in Wyoming recently, a few years ago, passed a kind of a ballot initiative to voluntarily tax itself to build safer roads. So there are some great examples out there of communities that have advocated to make their roads safer.
And in your book, and you, as you record in your book, you know, this, I learned a lot of things in the book, this whole business of barriers and the mule deer tell some really interesting stories. In the first place, I didn't know mule deer migrated.
Yeah.
But talk about a little bit about the solution in Wyoming to getting mule deer from one spot to the next.
Yeah, you know, Wyoming was at least historically really a leader in building these wildlife crossings, you know, these passages, both under and over highways that allow animals to keep moving. You know, and mule deer are a good case study for these sorts of passages because, you know, they, as you say, Larry, they migrate in these large herds in some cases. And, you know, when a herd of 1,000 mule deer crosses the highway and, you know, 50 of them get hit, there's this big pile of carcasses saying, you know, hey, put the wildlife crossing right here, right? So, you know, it's starting in the 1970s. Wyoming and Colorado and Utah and other states with these migratory mule deer herds, you know, really began building, you know, often large box culverts that allowed these animals to keep moving. And those, you know, those structures are incredibly effective. You know, they typically reduce wildlife collision rates by about 90%. They often pay for themselves by preventing all of these dangerous, expensive crashes. You know, and now where we're at is, so, you know, we're starting to build more of these things, or at least trying to build more of these things in Midwestern and Eastern states as well. You know, one of the challenges, I think, is that because white-tailed deer don't really migrate, you know, I think that it's harder to identify hotspots in some cases, right? There's no big pile of carcasses saying, put the crossing here, because, you know, white-tailed deer just kind of all over the place. But there are some, you know, some really great examples in Virginia, for example, where basically, you know, the DOT fenced off this section of highway and used the fence to guide the deer to a couple of existing stream crossings. And the deer used those stream crossings, and, you know, roadkill rates went down dramatically. So, you know, I think we know really well at this point how to mitigate this problem for migratory mule deer and elk and antelope and other Western animals. And now Eastern and Midwestern states are getting more interested in these sorts of solutions as well.
Bob in Madison has a question, a comment relating to migration. Let's go there. Bob, hi.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, you're welcome. Very interesting topic here. And I was wondering, we've mostly been talking about roads and road right-of-ways, but there are large animal movement and migration patterns that are increasingly interrupted by tall buildings, city buildings, as well as energy projects. Now, we certainly need alternative energy sources, but is there anything to be learned by what we've learned in road ecology that we can apply to reducing losses from those other sources?
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Just a few months ago, I was in Chicago, which is the bird glass collision capital of the world, writing about solutions to exactly what that listener's talking about, you know, these migratory flocks of all kinds of birds that unfortunately collide with windows during their migrations. And, you know, I think that, you know, just as road ecology has identified these solutions to this problem, you know, we actually have a pretty good idea of how to prevent window collisions. You know, there are lots of buildings out there that are bird safe, and it's not necessarily very complicated. You know, it's just don't build these giant glassy towers that you know, that birds can't detect. You know, there are some great buildings in Chicago and other cities that just have, you know, sort of architectural elements like balconies that just, you know, break up that glassy silhouette and make the building a little bit more conspicuous. You know, there are films that you can use as kind of a retrofit solution over big, you know, glass-fronted lobbies, for example. Fritted or patterned glass is much more detectable to birds than transparent glass, obviously. I mean, in some cases, it's even as simple as just moving potted plants and trees away from, you know, from glass-fronted lobbies, because birds, you know, are attracted to that vegetation and, of course, hit the glass on the way over there. So, you know, I think that both of these issues, both vehicle collisions and window strikes, are issues that, you know, they're problems that we have a pretty good sense at this point of how to address. And now it's just about summoning the political will and the funding and the interest to address them.
You know, I wanted to get to noise because I found that interesting. You write about noise as another way that roads are harmful, and the noise that they create. And by the way, what's the largest part noise? The loudest part of a car?
It's the tires.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do road noises? Well, as you write about, they stress animals.
Right. And, you know, and they're a form of habitat loss in a sense, right? You can, you know, imagine being an owl, for example. You know, you spend your life listening for the very faint crunch of a mouse's feet in the leaf litter. And of course, if, you know, if the constant rumble of engines and tires prevents you from hearing that subtle acoustic signal, you know, you functionally can't live in that place, right? So, you know, I think that's something that we often overlook about roads is you know, they seem so narrow, right? They're just, you know, 100 feet wide, let's say, from shoulder to shoulder, and yet they cast this acoustic shadow of noise pollution that, you know, can extend for a half mile in either direction and drives animals away from those places and thus inflicts habitat loss on a really large scale. And, you know, I'd add too that road noise is a huge problem for humans as well. You know, road noise is elevating our stress levels and our blood pressures and making us more susceptible to cardiac disease and stroke and diabetes. It's literally taking years off of our lives. So, you know, I've really come to feel that noise pollution is one of the great unsung ecological crises and public health crises of our time.
In the book, you mentioned what happens to the absence of road noise. You know, I think you mentioned the white-crowned sparrow during the pandemic.
Yeah, that's a really amazing story. So, you know, of course, the early days of COVID were one of the great inadvertent experiments in ecological history, right? What happens when you turn off traffic? And, you know, of course, there was much less roadkill, but animals also responded in other surprising ways. And one of those ways was, you know, with white-crowned sparrows, these, you know, wonderful, very vocal songbirds. You know, in the Bay Area, researchers did this study and basically found that without all of that noise pollution from traffic, sparrows sang. They sang these much more complex, intricate songs that you know, had much wider frequencies and pitches, and just kind of much better songs essentially, because they didn't have to scream to be heard over the noise of traffic. I think that just goes to show that, look, obviously COVID was this immense tragedy and disaster that we'd never want to repeat, but you know, animals are just waiting for for us to kind of pull back the pressure of our traffic a little bit. You know, they're still on the landscape, they're really flexible and adaptive, and if we just give them a chance to live their lives, you know, they're ready to respond.
None of us are solely responsible for the roads, and many of us don't have any option but to drive. But if someone listening wants to inspire change, what can they do?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Larry. I mean, I think that from a kind of a behavioral standpoint, you know, one of the things that I really try to avoid now is driving at night. I know that's unavoidable. In many cases, I just, you know, drove 3 hours back from the Denver airport last night at 10 o'clock at night. So I know that it's hard to avoid driving at night. But you know, I really do think that's when a really large majority of the roadkill occurs. And then I would just say, you know, look, I mean, advocate for the kinds of solutions that we know are effective for wildlife, you know, like these wildlife crossing structures. And it's actually a really exciting time in road ecology right now. You know, the 2021 Federal Infrastructure Act had $350 million for wildlife crossings in the form of this big federal grant program, and you know, and states have been applying for that funding. You know, really right now, essentially, you know, the Federal Highway Administration is, you know, trying to decide how to allocate that funding, and I'm not sure whether or not Wisconsin submitted an application for that grant funding, but you know, certainly it should be one of the states that's competitive, because, you know, I mean, Wisconsin, it always ranks very highly on national deer collision rates. So it's, you know, it's a big problem, and there's increasingly money to address it. And, you know, I would urge listeners to, you know, get involved and talk to elected officials and try to get this problem on their radar screen.
Ben, you've written a fascinating book, and I want to thank you once again for being with us to talk about it. And I hope we have a chance to visit again down the road. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Larry. Appreciate you having me.
Ben Goldfarb is the author of the book Crossings, the subtitle How Road Ecology is Shaping the Future of Our Planet. Sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it works a lot of times on this program. Well, just to look ahead, tomorrow it's the untold story of America's first women astronauts. We'll go back to the late 70s to hear about the six women to fly. They were selected to fly in NASA's untested space shuttle. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.